Hello, I'm Jason Rockman. This is number 0194, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0194. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Lisa Sarasoli, who is the author of As Nora Jo Fades Away, the story of how she took in her grandmother after she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
My husband and I took care of my gram for 6 or 7 years total, and the last 3 years were full-time in our home. But then it got to the point where it was completely unsafe for her to live alone. And the decision we made, we call it our rescue mission, because she never had a driver's license, so she was really housebound her whole life. She had 2 kitchens. She made Italian food professionally. She sold it for a living. So this is the kind of woman who, her house really was her castle. It was her home, her sanctuary. Leaving it was terrifying. For her.
Criminal defense lawyer Dennis Walsh is the author of Nobody Walks, Bringing My Brother's Killer to Justice. He worked hard to find the killer who gunned down his brother. It's something he felt he had to do.
It's not that I wanted to, it's that I really had to, because information was coming out. People were contacting me and letting me know that there were people that were out there that had information, material information, and they were either afraid of the killers or they were involved in that criminal lifestyle and they didn't cooperate with law enforcement. So I didn't want the case to become a cold case, so I started talking to these people, and my goal was to shepherd them towards the police.
Actor Oscar Torre has quite a few films coming out this year, including The Hangover 3. He was thrilled when he got the call to be in the third installment of the hit comedy trilogy.
My manager, Eileen O'Farrell, I remember that call when she said, she goes, honey, you got it, because I had auditioned twice. And I thought it went well, but you never know. At the end of the day, you never know. I've had good auditions that didn't go my way, and bad auditions that went my way. But that was a call that I was like, oh, thank God. Especially I have been a fan of the movies. It's not often that you get to be in a film that you've been a fan of.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0194, was Jason Rockman, DJ from SHOM 97.7 FM here in Montreal. And he's also the lead singer of the Montreal rock metal band Slaves on Dope. And if that's not enough, he's the pop culture columnist on CTV News Channel, and he's also a father of two. Thank you very much, Jason, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Much appreciated. A program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, we go to Bartholomew County, Indiana. Sheriff's deputies there were advised at 3 a.m. to watch out for a drunk driver. A deputy quickly spotted the described vehicle as it pulled into a McDonald's drive-thru, but as the deputy pulled in, the driver let out the passenger that he had and then sped off. I was going to get in trouble anyway, so, you know, I decided to run, the driver, James Thornburg, later said. Now, the chase exceeded 110 miles per hour, which didn't surprise Thornburg. I think I was going a little faster than that, he said. Deputies used stop sticks to flatten all of his tires, which only slowed the chase down to 40 miles per hour. But Thornburg, age 26, kept going until he spotted another McDonald's where he pulled in and was making an order when deputies caught up with him and took him into custody. His blood alcohol level was measured at 0.16%. He was charged with DUI, endangerment, and resisting officers. So what does Thornburg say about it now? It was fun, he said. I had a blast. It was just like a video game. Yeah, except in video games you get more than one life. For you, pal, this means game over. And by the way, what is it with the fascination with McDonald's drive-thrus anyway? Yeah, that's what I want to know. Okay, here's the quote of the day. Obviously, we can't have someone running through a Walmart parking lot shooting at a deer. You know, if I had a nickel for every anytime. That quote comes from Pennsylvania Wildlife Conservation Officer Jack Lucas, who was called in to investigate just that very incident in Burrell Township. It happened at 2:10 p.m. That's the middle of the afternoon on the first day of rifle season for whitetail. Arcangelo Bianco Jr., age 40, spotted a 10-point buck in the parking lot. Bianco jumped out of his pickup and began firing multiple rounds at the deer. He then pursued the deer through the parking lot and across Old William Penn Highway, where he killed the deer. Bianco then loaded the deer into his vehicle and took it to a meat processor for butchering. Lucas charged Bianco with hunting without a license, shooting on or across highways, unlawful killing or taking of big game, and reckless endangerment. The fool. Doesn't he know Walmart parking lots are for camping, not hunting? Everything happens at Walmart. Yeah. Okay, who says chivalry is dead? Authorities say a South Florida man nearly drowned after jumping into a storm drain seeking a woman's dropped keys, fortified first by chugging a bottle of rum to keep warm. Miami Beach police say 49-year-old Richard Brandenburg told the woman that he had experience working in sewer systems and was willing to go in and look for her keys. Witnesses say Brandenburg then drank a half pint of rum and smoked a cigarette, telling them it was to keep warm in the cold water. Police say Brandenburg went down twice, emerging each time to have another smoke. He didn't come back up the third time when he tried, and witnesses called 911. Authorities found Brandenburg by popping a nearby manhole cover, then performing CPR to revive him. Brandenburg is recovering at a local hospital. No word, by the way, on the missing keys. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, two Spanish men were apparently so desperate for cash, they decided to make a false $5 million insurance claim by cutting off their hands. Unfortunately for the alleged fraudsters, they were found to have done too good of a job in amputating their limbs. The medics said one of the men, who was claiming to have been maimed in a car accident, had a cut that was too clean. The hapless man, who has not been named, thought he'd be able to fool 11 insurance companies out of $4 million by chopping his hand off with an electric saw. The cut was too clean between the bone for the car crash, which is never so clean, said accident investigator Jose Luis Nieto. This man might have gotten someone to saw the hand off for him. A surgeon would never have done it. The second insurance claim went a step further by cutting off his lower arm and claiming $1 million for an electric saw accident. His claim was also rejected after an investigation. Now, the thing that I find so bizarre about these two stories is that they are just that, two separate stories. The cases are not linked at all. And the fact that the two cases are not linked, like I said, it's just fascinating to me. I mean, what? Is there some sort of website out there called Removing Limbs for Fun and Profit that these guys are going to? And now that I've publicly mentioned that title for a website, there probably will be one very soon. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Writer and filmmaker Lisa Sarasoli is the author of As Nora Jo Fades Away. It's a nonfiction account of caring full-time for her grandmother who suffered from Alzheimer's. But just because it's a serious and personal subject matter to Lisa doesn't mean she can't find the humor in the situation. Lisa's on the line with us right now to talk about her book. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you for having me.
I saw a trailer to the film that you've done, and it sounds like your grandmother, first of all, was quite the character just generally.
Yeah, my grandma had the greatest sense of humor, and, you know, the interesting thing is you don't know what's going to happen when you get Alzheimer's disease, so you don't know, like, what parts of their personality are sort of going to, you know, travel along with the illness and what parts are going to, well, as my book, as the title of my book states, As Nora Jo Fades Away, like what parts are going to fade away. And she certainly took her sense of humor with her right up until the end. And in fact, we dubbed her our Archie Bunker in really great drag because she became so off color with this illness, but it was still really funny because she just always had great timing.
Now, you became a caregiver for your grandmother when she became ill, and you had her at home, correct?
I did. My family and I, and my husband and I, took care of my gram for 6 or 7 years total, and the last 3 years were full-time in our home. The first three were part-time, where we would take her up for the weekends or go stay with her. But then it got to the point where it was completely unsafe for her to live alone, and the decision we made, we call it our rescue mission. In the book, I refer to it as a rescue mission because she never had a driver's license, so she was really housebound her whole life. She had two kitchens. She made Italian food professionally. She sold it for a living. So this is the kind of woman who, her house really was her castle. It was her home, her sanctuary. Leaving it was terrifying for her. She simply would not entertain the idea of a memory care facility, even though there's many, many fabulous ones all over the world. But she could sort of understand that, you know, if she lived with us, she would still be safe and we would be helping her. At the same time, she didn't pack a single thing ever. We tried this plan for almost a year. And finally, we just basically hijacked my grandma. I'm like, I'm going to take her somewhere. You and your buddies go over. I said to my husband, you and your buddies go over her house and move everything into our house. And I mean, that's what we did. It was a 24-hour thing, and it was more or less a rescue mission. I don't think we really knew what we were getting into, and which is why I've stated numerous times that that's when our life shifted from Michigan to Mars. It was really shocking experience to have her there full time. I didn't really think it would be because we had her there part time, but it was shocking for everybody.
The thing about Alzheimer's that the doctors will tell you is that it's in most cases it's not a situation where there's pain to the person who is suffering from it, but there's a lot of emotional pain for those around them who have to deal with it.
I think like the number one thing that probably makes people, that challenges people is the redundancy, especially if you're living with someone full time. You know, asking the same question 25 times in an hour sounds like a horrible experience, right? I mean, now, you know, times that times 24 hours in a day. So that was probably the hardest thing for me. I would say the second hardest thing for me was that I was confined to the house more. However, my gram was still mobile, and I had a two-year-old. She went from ages 2 to 5 while my grandma lived there. And I was at home anyway because I had a small child, but my small child was really active. So, and my gram could still walk. So we would take her places too, even when she didn't want to, because my gram was pretty good for someone who was 89 years old. You know, physically, she was in pretty good shape. But redundancy, being stuck in the home. And then, you know, this illness, unfortunately, does a lot of crazy things too, you know. It unravels the ability to function daily. And some of those examples, like taking off her clothes, changing, dressing, undressing, you know, she got the order of that mixed up all the time. She sort of lost the idea of private and public. You know, she forgot how to shut doors or lock doors or open doors. You know, so all those things happen too. Hmm.
Did you ever reach a point, or did she ever reach a point where she didn't know who you were or thought you were a daughter or a girlfriend or somebody from her past?
The last whole year of her living with me, she always thought I was one of her sisters. And I kept thinking, I know I look like I'm in my 80s because, man, am I tired. And at first it was like an insult because I'm like, I do. I look this tired. You know, I haven't combed my hair in 3 days. I've been wearing the same outfit. You know, I would still shower regularly. I managed to do that. But like so many other things were shot out the window. Makeup, gone. So the whole last year, she didn't get my name right very often. And when she did get my name right, she still thought I was one of her sisters. I think, though, and this is in one of the scenes in my movie, I think she didn't think she was as old as she was. I really think she thought she was younger, you
right.
know?
Yeah. Now, the book, As Nora Jo Fades Away, you wrote this book. Was this, first of all, a cathartic situation for you to write this? And who were you trying to write this for? Who do you see your most prime reader is?
I feel like the book, it's twofold. One is I did write it for caregivers because the first year I was with her, this was before I wrote the book, I thought, I cannot be the only person struggling like this. I was experiencing guilt, resentment, exhaustion. I felt incapable of doing the job that I took on, but I had too much of an ego to ask anybody else for help. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to write about this because I think that there's a lot of other people, hundreds of thousands of people feeling the same way I do, and nobody wants to talk about it because the guilt will eat you alive. So that is one reason that I wrote it. But I did write it to read like a novel, and it was easy to write it in the fashion of a character piece because I think that my grandma is quite the character, and my two-year-old is quite the character. So it was sort of easy to write it like a novel and like a character piece because I wanted anybody to want to read this book, not just people who are experiencing Alzheimer's, but people who may be experiencing it 10 years from now or 20 years from now. They can actually pick up a book that's entertaining and emotion-evoking and poignant and just funny, and they're getting an education from it, but they don't even know it. So that's sort of how I felt as I was writing the book.
As you say, you put your life, you put your career on hold to do this. You are an author, a filmmaker, an actress. You spent quite a bit of time on General Hospital. Have you picked up where you left off after taking care of your grandmother?
I'm still trying to pick up all the little pieces and put them back together, but since I moved to Michigan for caregiving, I've maintained all my LA ties. I don't even know how some days, but I have. Since I've been back in Michigan, I have two published books and my film, which I think is, you know, pretty good all considered. There's not a whole lot going on in Michigan that lends to me being a filmmaker, writer, and an actor. The only acting I've actually done is obviously in my documentary, which my mother says, well, you look as bad as I've ever seen you look, but your acting is the best I've ever seen it. And I think that's hilarious. I'm just like, Mom, I was too tired to act badly. There's no overacting in the documentary or probably in anybody's documentary. But I'm thinking about a second film. I'm working on three books. I'm working on the book 14 Days with Alzheimer's, the same title as the movie, because I never did write the sequel to As Nora Jo Fades Away. And she did not die in my book. So I have a lot more stories about the last year with my gram. And, I fly to L.A. frequently. So I would say that I'm really holding it together here, even though it's a little more challenging.
Mm. You cared for your grandmother, who was very active. You have a daughter who is very active. You're the generation literally in the middle. At any point when you were taking care of your grandmother and this was going on in your house, did you ever sit back and think, is this something that's in my future as well?
Oh, I think that all the time. And every time I speak, which is a lot, I'm going to Kansas City, Missouri next week for like 10 conferences, I think, on Alzheimer's. And people ask me if I think that. And I think that it's impossible not to think that you have the illness when you're taking care of someone with this illness. I think that there's not a single caregiver on the planet who would say it never crossed my mind. It crosses my mind right now, and I'm young. And we don't have early onset Alzheimer's in our family. We have a family history of Alzheimer's, and my relatives and my grandmother and my grandfather, they were all in their mid-80s when they were diagnosed. So that's more or less age-related, which is the number one factor for getting Alzheimer's disease, that you just keep aging. And they call it family history instead of genetics. It does not prevent me probably once a day if I lose my keys, which, by the way, is not an indicator. Losing your keys is not an indicator. Finding your keys and not knowing what they're for is an indicator that you might need to get checked out. But, yeah, I think about it all the time.
The book is called As Nora Jo Fades Away. It's written by Lisa Sarasoli, and you can check out her website, lisasarasoli.com. There's also the film 14 Days with Alzheimer's. Lisa, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. Have a great day.
Lisa Sarasoli, author of As Nora Jo Fades Away. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0194, and you'll find links to Lisa's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Batteries not included, some assembly required.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Nobody Walks, Bringing My Brother's Killers to Justice. Plus, actor Oscar Torre is on the program. He's one of the stars of the new film, The Hangover 3. And we have lots more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. As a matter of fact, more Stuff File news right here, right now. When Judge Heidi Ladd arrived for work at the Champaign, Illinois Circuit Courthouse, a car was parked in her spot. Court security went looking for the driver. The first place they looked was in Judge John Kennedy's courtroom, where a number of defendants were waiting for hearings. Sure enough, defendant Bob Blue Dagby, that's his name, age 28, stepped forward when he heard his car described. As he was moving his car, security officers checked on Dagby. He was in court to face charges of felony DUI and driving with a suspended license thanks to a previous DUI conviction in Arizona. After Dagby pleaded guilty to the charges, a sheriff's deputy was there to issue him another citation for driving to the courthouse without a license, and a city police officer was there to cite him for illegal parking. It could have been worse. He could have been drunk and parked in Judge Kennedy's spot. I almost made this clown the idiot of the day, but I didn't. That comes later. Okay. For years, James McCormick, age 56, of Langport, Somerset, England, has been selling fake bomb detectors. The detectors were simply relabeled novelty golf ball detectors that McCormick sold for up to $40,000 each to various governments, including the countries of Georgia, Romania, Niger, Thailand, and Saudi Arabia. Over 2 years, the Iraqi government bought 6,000 of the devices at a cost of over $40 million and was using them at checkpoints throughout the country. Between 2008 and 2009 alone, more than 1,000 Iraqis were killed in explosions in Baghdad, and thousands more were injured because checkpoint officers were relying on the fake devices to detect bombs. When people passed through checkpoints using these devices, they thought they would be safe, said Haneen Alwan, who was severely injured in a bomb blast. But they are useless. The man who sold them has no conscience. He is morally bankrupt. How can he sell just for money and destroy other people's lives? McCormick has been convicted of fraud. You know, someone needs to invent a BS detector because it would have really rung off the hook with this clown. And Chicago, Illinois police officer Tom Rowland responded to a report of a woman foaming at the mouth and lying in the street. When he arrived, Shermaine Miles, age 51, jumped up and greeted him by name. He had arrested her before. This was her 396th arrest in that city alone. And since 1978, she's been jailed under at least 83 aliases, with 92 arrests for theft, 65 for disorderly conduct, 59 for prostitution-related crimes, and 5 for robbery or attempted robbery. Miles has spent most of her life either in foster care, mental institutions, or jail. But she's adept at working the system and always serves less time than sentenced. She's currently in jail for a possible parole violation of a 2010 conviction of robbing a 75-year-old man at knife point. That could keep her in prison another year. She should never be released, the victim says. Nah, that only can happen after she starts shooting people, apparently. And by the way, we still don't know why she was foaming at the mouth. That seems to be lost in this story somewhere. And while we're talking about bodily functions, a University of Saskatchewan professor hypothesizes a person could benefit from picking his or her nose and eating the findings. Scott Napper, a biochemistry professor at the Saskatoon School, posed the unsavory hypothesis to his students. He said, by consuming those pathogens caught within the mucus, could that be a way to teach your immune system about what it's surrounded with? I've got two beautiful daughters, and they spend an amazing amount of time with their fingers up their nose, he said. And without fail, it goes right into their mouths afterward. Could they just be fulfilling what we're truly meant to do? Napper said he has an experiment designed to test the hypothesis. All you would need is a group of volunteers. You would put some of the molecule in all their noses, and for half of the group, they would go about their normal business, and the other half of the group, they would pick their nose and eat it, he said. Then you could look for immune responses against the molecule, and if they're higher in the booger eaters, then that would validate the idea. Weren't the booger eaters the kids we used to shun at school? I usually stay with the theory that whatever comes out of my body generally stays out of my digestive system, or anybody else's, for that matter. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Dennis Walsh is a criminal defense attorney and the author of Nobody Walks, Bringing My Brother's Killers to Justice. It's the true story of how Walsh avenged the murder of his youngest brother. Dennis joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you for being on the program with us. So you wrote this book after going through the situation of basically trying to find your brother's killer. We should go back in time a little bit. Your brother was killed. He was gunned down in July of 2003, correct?
That's correct.
And he was, and I'm looking at the press material here, he was shot 5 times in the head and neck and stuffed headfirst into a trash barrel.
They had left him lay for about a day or two. They cut his face. I heard there was some torture involved. They stuffed his body in a trash can and sealed in a storage facility in Van Nuys, California. And then the principal shooter was arrested on an underlying shootout with a deputy. So he was sitting in county jail with a body in a storage facility that he hadn't completely disposed of yet.
Now, what made you go through the process of trying to seek justice? I mean, I know you're a criminal defense attorney, but you didn't hand it over to detectives or let the police handle it. You wanted to help in the search as well, correct?
Well, what happened, it's not that I wanted to, it's that I really had to, because information was coming out. People were contacting me and letting me know that there were people that were out there
that had information, material information, and they were either afraid of the killers or they were involved in that criminal lifestyle and they didn't cooperate with law enforcement. So I didn't want the case to become a cold case, so I started talking to these people, and my goal was to shepherd them towards the police, to get them to come forward and tell what they knew, because I really didn't know what was material, what would be helpful. I just wanted them to talk to the police.
Now, as you say, people were afraid to talk because they were afraid of the killers involved and repercussions from them. Did you fear for your life in pursuing this?
I had a healthy concern for my safety. I carried a weapon with me. I felt that my brother underestimated them, and he was dead, so I wasn't going to let that happen. But I was so consumed with making sure that the culprits would pay that basically the way I was raised in a family where my father had been a Cleveland detective, left the police force, and got involved with organized crime, I was able to submerge myself in that world and deal with it in a way that got results.
Now, you found the people, or you, with your persistence, you helped to find the people who killed your brother. Did you find out why they killed your brother?
The principal shooter took the witness stand. Of course, he denied any complicity, any involvement. So the real reasons, we don't know. I have to believe that the principal reason was the fact that my brother witnessed the prior shootout with the deputy. He was a witness to that. And he had been living with the principal shooter, David Michael Steinberg, and they weren't getting along. So he got rid of his problem and his witness all in one fell swoop.
Now, your brother, and we should mention your brother's name, Christopher John Walsh, your brother had a bit of a shady past himself, correct?
Yeah, he had gotten involved with crystal meth. I would say he was addicted to that and was involved in mostly petty crimes. And, like I said, associated with these people, and it's just a bad... You put yourself in harm's way when you're around or dealing with these people.
Your brother got involved in crime. You already mentioned earlier that your father was a police officer, but then later he got involved in crime. You are a criminal defense lawyer. The whole situation of nature versus nurture, what makes you lead or walk the straight and narrow when you had people in your family who clearly at some point did not?
I think, Peter, the reason is I can remember when I was probably 4 years old, when my father was a detective, when he'd come home with his fedora hat, the cashmere overcoat, the shoulder holster, and I looked up to him, and I'm the oldest of seven children in my family, and they didn't have that experience. So they grew up under that umbrella of crime, and they kind of romanticized that life. I just wish that my father had stayed on the police force, and probably my brothers would have been policemen and firemen, and my younger brother might still be alive.
How did you end up as a criminal defense attorney?
When we were younger, I was pretty wild on the streets and whatnot, and I was always the one that wound up talking to the police and thought I had a knack for it, and my father encouraged me to go to school. As a matter of fact, I had told him that I didn't want to go to college, so he took me out one day. He said, get in the car. So I didn't question him. I got in the car, and he took me over to the GM plant. Right as they were getting off work, the shifts were changing, and there were hundreds of employees crossing the street in their with their lunch buckets and their overalls. And he said to me, he said, now you see all these people? He said, they're like your uncles, pipe fitters back east. These people work hard, but they lead really difficult lives. He said, I think you've got some brains. If you want to live a better life, you need to go to school and do something with your life. And I really, it didn't make that much of an impression on me until I got drafted and I joined the Navy. And I used to lay in my bunk at night and think about that. And when I got out, went back to college, got on the dean's list, and went to law school.
And as you say, you idolized your father when you were a young child. You never thought of becoming a police officer and a detective yourself?
I did. And I told my father that I was going to get on the LAPD and go to law school at night. And he said, oh, BS. He said, you know, you'll be on the force for 40 years. You'll never finish school. And he kind of talked me out of it. they probably, you know, on the background check, probably wouldn't have taken me anyways because of him. I don't know that, but I think I would have been a homicide detective.
In this book, Nobody Walks, Bringing My Brother's Killers to Justice, in writing this, has this been somewhat cathartic for you?
Actually, writing it was like reliving it. I felt every emotion. It was really difficult to write it, not in the sense of actually putting the words to paper, because it really flowed. I mean, I carried that story around in my head for 7 years or so. But it was just, it was like reliving it, and I'm still reliving it with all the interviews and the, there's some movie people looking at it now, so it goes on, and there's some talk about me writing the prequel story, the true story of my father's life, so I guess, you know, like they say, just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
And they always say, write what you know, too.
Yeah, yeah.
In writing this story and in doing all the research, did you learn anything or get a different appreciation for your brother?
I did, because I hadn't spoken to him for about a year and a half prior to his murder. I had bailed him out on some petty drug charge and told him that was it for me. But when I was on the streets dealing with these people, there was a lot of people that came forward that really loved him. They told me some great stories about him, how he had helped them out, how he was trying to get his life back together, how he had seen a minister, was talking about trying to get his kids back and get on the right path. And that really, really meant a lot to me to hear that. And I just wish that I could have done more to help him out instead of being estranged from him.
You're the oldest of seven, as you say. Your brother had children. You have I'm assuming a large extended family.
That's correct.
What have they said, if anything, about your book, Nobody Walks?
Everybody seems to like it. My brothers and sisters, Christopher's kids. My mother hasn't been able to get through it. It's been too difficult for her, and I certainly understand that. But she told me that she thought my father and my brother would be proud of me, not only for doing what I did on the streets and helping to get Christopher's murderers convicted, but in writing the book as well. So I think it's brought everybody closer even.
The book is called Nobody Walks, Bringing My Brother's Killers to Justice. How can one get their hands on the book?
It's available on Amazon online, Barnes & Noble. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books, a division of St. Martin's Press, and should be readily available online.
Dennis, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, thank you.
Dennis Walsh, author of Nobody Walks, Bringing My Brother's Killers to Justice. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0194, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A Michigan college student says she needs a guinea pig for emotional support, and she sued her college for the right to bring the animal into her classes and cafeteria. The student was diagnosed with chronic depression and prescribed the guinea pig for emotional support. Grand Valley State University actually allowed her to keep the furry rodent in her room, but when it refused to let her bring the animal to class and where people eat, the student sued. The university denies doing anything wrong, but it recently agreed to pay the 28-year-old student $40,000 to save further legal costs. Let's be fair. Depression is a serious condition, and the college tried to accommodate the student by changing its policy of no animals in their dorm rooms. Is it really too much to ask this student to accommodate her classmates who don't want to eat with a rodent? Lawsuits like this are the last thing we need as we try to keep education affordable. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to actor Oscar Torre. Plus, we have an idiot of the day coming your way. But right now, we have one more Stuff File news story before we get to our next guest. Stella English, age 34, was paid £100,000. That's more than $152,000 US per year to, as she said, do no real work. So she sued her boss, Lord Alan Sugar. The job at his information technology company had been her prize for winning the British version of The Apprentice. A London Employment Tribunal judge said English had expected a much more glamorous role than she received, one involving assisting Sugar and accompanying him on his private plane. But the judge said she had not been promised Sugar's personal mentoring, and Sugar speculated that English brought the case in the hope that he'd settle rather than testify. But he testified, and he won. Good going, pal. He's already paid her enough for not doing anything useful on the job. So, there you go. On to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Actor Oscar Torre is keeping pretty busy these days. He will be in the soon-to-be-released The Hangover 3, and he is also in the boxing film coming out, which is called Counterpunch. And Oscar joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Oscar.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I first became aware of your acting from the unfortunately short-lived television show Kane, which was on CBS back in 2007. That was a great show.
It was. It was. For me, it was a blessing to be able to be part of such a great cast.
Yeah. And one of the things that's also interesting is there were a lot of lead characters in that show that were Latino, which is not something you always see in mainstream television these days.
No. I think it's one of the few shows ever. I think it was the first one-hour TV series to have a whole Latino cast, because I think they had a miniseries before, or it was qualified as a miniseries, but I think this was the first time to have a whole Latino cast.
Now, in that show, you played a little bit of a bad boy, correct?
I was a guy with a bit of an edge. I played Santo. I thought it was a fascinating character, because he had recently come from Cuba, so he was kind of like a fish out of water in the U.S., but at the same time, he was a killer, but very loyal to the main character, to Jimmy Smith's character, and he would do whatever he needed to do to save Jimmy Smith's family.
Mm. Now, in addition to doing that, it so happens in that same year, 2007, you also did To Rob a Thief, which was a Spanish language comedy, correct?
It was a comedy. It was a kind of like Ocean's 11, similar to Ocean's 11, and I played the comedic role in the film.
So, were you ever concerned, working in Spanish or working in English, were you ever concerned about being typecast? You know, like I say, you played this tough crook, this bad guy in Kane, and you're doing a comedy. Some people don't get that chance a lot.
No, it was a blessing. I remember I shot the film, and it was screened when we started shooting Kane, and Jimmy Smith went to the screening of the film, the screening before the film came out in theaters, and he was like, you know, this doesn't happen often, that you get to be in a television show playing a really dark character, and on the other hand, be in a film, in a Lionsgate film that was released theatrically, and playing the comedic role. I was playing an out-of-work actor who's recruited to be a con man. But he gets himself in a lot of trouble. He's way over his head.
What do you prefer, comedy or drama?
I like both. I've done a lot more drama than comedy, but I always try to find the humor. When I'm doing drama, I always try to find humor, and I think that's one of the things that I brought to the character of Kane. Actually, I think that's one of the things that got me a role when I auditioned, was that the character was really dark. And growing up, I was born and raised in Miami, where the series supposedly took place. All we shot in L.A. I knew a lot of these characters, and these guys, you know, they would make you laugh until only you got stabbed. So, That was something I was trying to bring to the character, you know, that humor, you know, making fun of things, of not taking things too serious, even if, you know, it was a life and death situation.
Now, I in keeping in that trend, doing comedy and doing drama, you're at it again. You've got two films coming out this year. One's a comedy, one's a drama, correct?
One's a comedy, yeah. Hangover 3 is a big comedy. It's a big comedy. All of my roles, I can't say much about what I do in the film because they're very secretive. All of my role is humorous, and my scenes are humorous. I play it straight, totally straight.
The first two Hangovers were such big hits. What was it like getting the call from your agent, I would assume? You got Hangover 3.
Well, Hangover 3, my manager, Eileen O'Farrell, called me. I remember that call when she said, "Honey," she goes, "Honey, you got it." Because I had auditioned twice. I auditioned for the casting director, Mindy Marin, a great casting director here in L.A., and then I auditioned for Todd Phillips, the director. And I thought it went well, but you never know. At the end of the day, you never know. I've had good auditions that didn't go my way and bad auditions that went my way. So it's you never know these things. But that was a call that I was like, oh, thank God. Especially I have been a fan of the movies. So it's not, you know, it's not often that you get to be in a film that you've been a fan of.
Mm. And now you keep branching out as well, because I understand you have a movie coming out. There's a lot of another movie coming out. There's a lot of
that pressure. That just came out. Counterpunch.
Yeah, but there's another one I want to talk about.
Okay.
One that is your directorial debut.
Oh yes, Pretty Rosebud.
Yes, and as if that's not nerve-wracking enough for you to be in a movie that you're starring in, to have your directorial debut, you're also starring in it with your wife who wrote it. No pressure there, huh?
No pressure there. We had no idea how what it would be like. Although my role is a crucial role in the film, I'm not really carrying the film. So I was smart enough not to put that much weight on my back. She's the main character in the film. She's pretty much in every scene. And it's a film that she wrote, but you're right. It was nerve-wracking. At first, it wasn't nerve-wracking when I was on the set. I faked it. I acted as if I knew what I was doing. But I didn't know what it would be like to work with her. I had never worked with her, and especially direct her. And since she never pays attention to me at home, I really didn't know what it would be like to direct her. But she was great. She was really great. She was 100% professional, and it's the only time in my whole entire life that she's listened to me.
Okay, so you have this relationship at home, obviously. What did you learn about each other through the acting, directing process of Pretty Rosebud?
That's easy to be to direct her. Just kidding. But it's true. I mean, she was totally professional. She was not my wife from the set, even though she could have, you know, I had no idea what it was going to be like. You know, and actors are a little neurotic. But she was 100% professional. And she said, once I'm on the set, I'm not your wife. I'm the actress who you're directing. And you're the boss. And she behaved that way. And she was great in the film. She was totally professional. I mean, I wish every actor that I ever directed in my career would be as professional and as prepared as she was.
Well, now that you've got the directing bug, do you want to do it more?
I definitely want to do it more. When I finish directing film, anybody who's directed can tell you, you know, it's the most stressful job that you can do in the show business, I think. I'm like, I need a break. I don't know if I want to direct again. Too much responsibility, and everybody's coming to you, and you're in charge of everything. But once you know, once you take that little break, you get that bug. You're like, at least I did. I love it, and something that I definitely want to do again. And it gives me power as a filmmaker, because as an actor, I can only play so many roles. And you know how it is: the older you get, the less roles you're able to get. Many times. and directing, I look at somebody like Clint Eastwood, I mean, he's in the 80s, and, I mean, he's still going at it big time.
How has directing in any way, shape, or form affected your acting? The experience of having directed now.
Well, it affected it a big way. First of all, I think I'm a better actor from directing. I am more aware of what the director's trying to do, what's going on behind the scenes. That's one thing. The other thing is I have even more respect than I had before, but I even have more respect for directors because I know what they're dealing with, and, you know, it's their vision. As an actor, you're a little selfish. As an actor, you're thinking of your role. You're thinking of this is your whole world. You're not thinking of the whole picture. You're just thinking of your job and what you need to do once you're in the set, and then you leave, and, you know, the director is directing other scenes with other actors and other parts of the storyline, but you're not sure how you fit in the whole picture. So I'm more respectful towards that because now I know, you know, I just know what I'm doing here in the set, but I don't know what his whole vision is.
You got the film Counterpunch out in this year. You have The Hangover Part 3 coming out this year. You had Pretty Rosebud this year. It's been a pretty good year for you. What, if anything, would you like to do to top all that?
Well, I'm waiting. I started in a sitcom last month, so I'm waiting to see if it gets picked up by a network. It's called What's Up in L.A. So that's the next. That would be nice, you know, because it'll be a steady job as an actor. You know, you shoot a film and then you're back to looking for work. So if this gets picked up, then I'll have a little bit of work there for at least a couple months straight working a television series, which kind of gives me some normalcy. Because as an actor, I mean, last year it was a blessing, but I spent a lot of time away from home. So working in a TV series in a way gives me more of a, it's not a 9-to-5 job. Especially, sitcoms are hard work. I had no idea that it would really be this hard. But you know, you go to a studio and you work all weekend and you're off the weekend. It's more like a normal job.
Well, we're going to see a lot more of Oscar Torre, I'm sure, with all the work that you've been doing. And good luck with that upcoming sitcom. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Peter, my pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
Actor Oscar Torre. To keep up with his busy acting schedule, you can check out his website at oscartorre.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0194, and you'll find links to Oscar's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A New Hampshire man who thought he had a decent ball toss said he lost his life savings, or about $2,600, playing a carnival game he claims was rigged. Henry Grigbaum was attempting to win an Xbox Kinect at the Manchester Carnival when things went awry. The 30-year-old was playing a game called Tubs of Fun, in which contestants toss balls into a tub, but the balls kept popping out. It's not possible that it wasn't rigged, Henry said. You just get caught up in the whole I've got to win my money back thing. Henry lost $300, then went home to get $2,300 more dollars, and soon lost all of that as well. Manchester police are investigating the incident, and New Hampshire-based Fiesta Shows, which produces the traveling carnival, is pulling Tubs of Fun for the time being. Henry, who managed to win a giant stuffed banana before dropping $2,600, says he is considering a lawsuit. For once in my life, I happen to become the sucker, he said. Henry. You lost $300 trying to win an Xbox Kinect, a game console, by the way, that costs about $300, so you could have just simply gone to the store or online and found one at that price. But no, you didn't stop there. You went home to get an additional $2,300. What, do you keep the money in your mattress? And then you lost that money still trying to win an Xbox. Well, we hope you're happy with your $2,600 giant banana. You say, Henry, that for once in your life you become a sucker? No, Henry. You have become an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0194. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0194. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.